Here's another edition of BayCare Health Systems podcast series, BayCare Health Chat with Melanie Cole.
If you've gone through a traumatic experience, it's normal to feel lots of emotions. However, if those emotions affect your life and last more than a month, you may have post-traumatic stress disorder. My guest today is Dr. Nick Duan. He's the Chief Medical Officer in the Behavioral Health Division of BayCare Health System. Dr. Duan, tell us about the current state of PTSD. What's the prevalence and what do we know about it?
Well, the post-traumatic stress disorder, as it's called, has been around for a number of decades, and especially because of the research we've had in terms of what I would call the Veterans Administration and also the Department of Defense, we've learned a great deal more about what I would call the nature of PTSD, the symptoms associated with PTSD, and how one approaches this condition. Now, in terms of how much there is a debate as to the what I would call the prevalence of PTSD in our community in general. The prevalence can range from 3% to 10% related to what data you're looking at. For instance, the most recent study looked at in U.S. adults, the prevalence was around 3.5%. Now, there are other studies that show it's less than 1%, but I think the 3.5% number is appropriate. Historically, when we look at lifetime risk, that's when you get near the 10%, and that data is around 8.7%. So in any given year, the data shows 3.5%. In any person's lifetime, the data says 8.7%. So that's the prevalence. In terms of the other things related to PTSD, in terms of how we've changed our definition of this disorder, we have changed what we call the criteria that one uses to diagnose this disorder in the past 5 to 10 years. And there are two critical things people need to remember. Number one, and I think you had mentioned this earlier, is that the duration of symptoms have to be at least 1 month long. And if it's less than 1 month, it's called an acute stress disorder. So point number one, it's got to be more than a month. The other thing that became more clear in terms of the definition, when you look at the word post-traumatic, it's obviously a traumatic event. And that traumatic event is defined as any exposure to an actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence. And that can mean directly experiencing the traumatic event, witnessing it, sometimes learning about it, and sometimes experiencing repeated, what I would call extreme exposures to the event. So those are the two things, the event itself and the duration of what I would call the symptoms post-event. And now those symptoms have been what I would call more clearly defined. For instance, recurrent intrusive distressing memories, recurrent intrusive distressing dreams. Sometimes even we call that in medical word dissociative reactions, but in what I would call the common terminology is flashbacks. And then there's what we would call intense distress associated with it. And there's also what's called physiological. Some people's heart will race, they'll be sweaty. So there's physical things that happen, and people tend to avoid situations, circumstances related to this. And a lot of times people have what's called mood and cognitive alterations. They also have what I would call this continued vigilance. They startle easily. So it's sort of like the adrenaline is sort of on hyperdrive. And so all those criteria, a mixture of those for 30 days in duration makes sort of what we would call the clinical criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a very debilitating, very gut-wrenching sort of disorder that, like I said, in anybody's lifetime, the U.S. data is about 8.7% for lifetime and 3.5% during any given year.
Why do some people suffer post-traumatic stress disorder and other people might have the same traumatic experience but not suffer PTSD? Tell us a little bit about risk factors or if there's a genetic component. And also, Dr. Dewan, do children react differently than adults to trauma?
Boy, those are some great questions you just asked me. So let me try to address little by little. Let's talk about risk factors. Now, when researchers study this issue, they divide what I would call risk factors into pre-traumatic factors, peritraumatic factors, or post-traumatic factors. So when we look at pre-traumatic factors, there's obviously the genetic. And now there is some research in terms of specific molecular or receptors in the brain that people are more vulnerable. We're doing research on that. There are environmental issues. Actually, people who have less social support, less, you know, more traumatic life experiences tend to have developed this disorder. And there's also what I would call, the researchers will say, temperamental kinds of pre-traumatic factors. Someone who has predisposing anxiety or predisposing, say, OCD characteristics may have greater likelihood of developing the disorder. We know that monozygotic twins have higher rates than dizygotic twins. So have we identified all the genes related to this that make people more vulnerable? No, we have not. But we do know it's a mixture of three different pre-traumatic factors. The what's called during the trauma, depending on the severity of it, the closer the person is to the trauma, the life threat or personal injury, especially if the violent event was quote, perpetrated by someone you knew, that carries much more significance. And then post-trauma, obviously, there's the environmental and once again, what the research will call temperamental, meaning what are people's usual coping strategies? What's their resilience capability? And what happens post-event in terms of their psychosocial support systems? Now, children can experience it differently. They sometimes cannot communicate. They can't verbalize what it feels like. They can't verbalize their thoughts as well, their dreams. So their manifestations are much more behavioral in nature. There might be more impulsivity, more what we call acting out, more distressful behaviors than, say, adults. So that's a little bit of the difference.
Speak about treatments then. What's the first form of treatment you might try? And do the symptoms ever go away with these treatments? Tell us about some of the treatments available.
And I think this is where I think we've made significant progress in the last two decades. We have a number of what I would call psychotherapies that have been researched in very large clinical trials. There's a type of therapy that's like cognitive behavioral therapy that's called cognitive processing therapy, where someone is in a therapeutic relationship with a therapist, gets to discuss the nature of the traumatic event, gets to be able to share their story and gets to understand the framework of that story in a way that they can know that it's not their fault, know that it's not happening again. And the more exposure people have to talking about the story in what I would call a therapeutic framework and context, the less fear, the less avoidance, the less startle response, the less vigilance they feel. There's also been some great work in what's called virtual reality therapy combined with cognitive processing therapy. And this is where I think both the military research and the veterans research has been tremendously helpful, where people sit with these, you've seen these game goggles that people have that they put on and you're in sort of this 3D world. Well, there's been some software development where you get exposed to specific traumas. Let's say it's military trauma. You get exposed to this and you do this in a therapeutic way. And sometimes you get medicine while you're experiencing that trauma to reduce what we would call the fear or the threat response during the re-experiencing of this trauma. So the pain is less. So I think we've made some great strides in the area of the psychotherapy aspects. Obviously, there's obviously medical interventions, and the most common treatment historically has been what we call SSRIs, and these have been around since the late 80s that there have been research done. And SSRIs can give you a 10 to 20 to 30% reduction in symptoms, similar to psychotherapy. But when people have very, very significant extreme symptoms, usually the combination is much more beneficial. There's also a high blood pressure pill, surprisingly, that people have been using for reducing nightmares. And now the specific high blood pressure pill given at night actually reduces nightmares, and you get sometimes 30 to 50% response rate. So I think we've come a long way from just antidepressants, just mood stabilizers, but now we're using things like high blood pressure pills. There's some other novel treatments that are being researched, and I'm not ready to sort of talk about those right now because that might, I don't want to talk about false expectations or there's a miracle cure around the corner. I'd rather talk about things that we know have worked for the past decade.
Then tell us what family and friends can do to help if they suspect that somebody is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. What would you like them to know about helping that loved one cope with the trauma? And what about self-care for somebody who's gone through a traumatic event?
All right, so let's talk about families and friends. First of all, what a family or friend can do, can say is, I know you're in pain. I've noticed you're getting more emotional, or you're impulsive, or you're backing off. You're not hanging out with us much more. Looks like you might be drinking a little bit more than you used to. I've noticed these, and I want you to know that I'm here to be your support, and I think I will go with you to the appointment. Let's set this up together. I've looked at some recent research, and people who suffer like this, if they have what I would call, everybody these days has their social network, let's say. Sometimes they have 5 people in their network, sometimes they have 500. But what they really need is a social supported network, meaning those people need to be identified as, hey, if I'm in trouble, I need you to be available for me. And that's what a friend or family can say to them. Say, here's my phone number. Here's where you can call me. Whenever you need something or you're feeling down, you call me. I am here for you. So those two things, getting them to the proper treatment and saying, I'm there for you, and here's my number. You tell me if you need me. I think those are the two things that people can do, family and friends can do, to help their loved one. One thing that people don't realize is horrific trauma really impacts not only people's emotions and sleep and energy level, it actually impacts their ability to remember and think clearly. So it really impacts everything to do with day-to-day life. And I think the things that we take for granted in terms of take care of yourself, do meditation, enjoy life, connect with others. There are now, most organizations have websites that people can go to practice mindfulness, to practice cognitive self-talk, support groups. And I think there's a world out there that people can say, you know what? There's been a lot of research done these past two decades. There's a lot of support out there. I'm going to take advantage of this. You know, this is, we are in the 21st century, and we have more data and more research and more capabilities now than we ever did before. And I think people that can self-manage this illness a lot better if they just seek out these tools. So that would be my recommendation to folks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dewan. It's a pleasure, as always, to have you on with such great information, and you're such a great educator. Thank you for educating us today about post-traumatic stress disorder and the treatments that are available and the ways that family and friends can help their loved ones. You're listening to BayCare Health Chat. For more information, please visit baycare.org. That's baycare.org. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for tuning in.